Morning, Kev.
Well, hello. Good morning, Sandra and John. Am I Sandra or Sandra?
Sandra.
I don't hear the difference, to be honest. I say, if you want to say it in French, it's Sandra.
Great. Just what we needed, a third pronunciation. Comic Cuts. We're looking at a panel, and we comprise a panel. There's a few of us. So the panel sees a panel, and we talk about the comics from the panel. We discuss, and we call it Comic Cuts.
Amazing.
Well done. That's a wrap.
In so many ways. Today's podcast may include strong language and adult themes. Let's just see what the next half hour holds. Hello and welcome to Comic Cuts, the panel show. My name's Kev F. Sutherland. You might know me as a writer and artist for Beano, Marvel Comics, Oink, Doctor Who, the Scottish Falsetto Sock Puppet Theatre, and my graphic novel adaptations of Shakespeare. But chances are you probably don't. My guests today talking comics are Sandra Mars and John Chalmers, a.k.a. Metafrog.
Hello.
Good morning, Kevin.
I have two guests with me today who brought with them a panel from a comic or something close. We're going to see if we can identify it and talk about it. Maybe we and you will learn something about comics we didn't already know, or maybe we'll just show off a bit and have an enjoyable chat. Let's see. And it's an unusual situation today because usually I have two separate and diverse people in different parts of the country or different parts of the world. Today, both from Glasgow and both sitting side by side, shoulder to shoulder, our husband and wife team, Metafrog. Good morning.
Good morning. We're not husband and wives, actually. We're together. We live together, but we're not actually married.
Are we not?
Did you not know?
I didn't realize that. You learn something every day.
Is that a common misconception? Because I must admit, I just automatically thought you were married. Then again, I am very old.
We're also quite common law, I guess, is the Scottish term, because we've been living together for 27 years.
How did you come together? Through comics?
No, actually, we didn't make comics before we met. Actually, we started making comics because we met. I moved from France when I was in my early 20s. And so I moved to Glasgow. And within a month, I met John, just by purely by chance, basically.
I think we probably did make comics when we were 4, 5, 7, you know, when we were young, both of us, but not together. I was also still in my 20s, but when Sandra says early 20s, she means literally 20. I met her just before her 21st birthday, and I was in my late 20s, so I was nearly 30. But we've been working, making comics since we met, which is quite unusual, because I was working in science and engineering before that.
Well, that's right.
Well, meeting Sandra kind of gave me the courage to become a writer.
So what sort of comics had you individually been making before you came together?
Like comics with crayons and bits of paper. I had characters called Mutt and Jeff, things like that.
I've got to say, Mutt and Jeff, not entirely original.
No. But then I was writing songs that I probably heard on the radio as well, like all mad young kids, you know.
I copied Tintin comics.
Copied.
I think both of these things are what kids do. A lot of kids who make comics are also making music and making other art. And a lot of people are copying comics, aren't they?
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
You get inspired by what you read, so you try to do it.
In comics, I think growing up, when I read Ur Willie and the Bruins and the Beano and the Dandy and maybe Spider-Man and Superman comics and Batman comics, I had no idea who the creators were. A lot of them were Scottish.
Well, that's right. Anonymity in comics was very much the order of the day with the British comics we were reading. And apart from Tintin, were you reading newer Bede, Sandra?
As a child, you mean?
Yeah.
There were actually older comics, which nobody's heard of in Britain. And I don't even have copies of it anymore. I don't even know if people remember these comics. They were called Sylvain and Sylvette. I think that was for early readers. I read a few Asterix. I wasn't quite so much into that. But no, I think that was about it. Then I kind of stopped reading comics from the age of maybe 11, 12, and I only rediscovered them when I was about 16 or something.
Sandra, it's very puzzling to most of us that you would come from France to Glasgow. Why?
That's what most people said when they met me. But they were like, why are you coming from France to Glasgow? It should be the other way around. I really wanted to travel and to live abroad. And Glasgow just happened to be the place that I ended up. It could have been anywhere else, I guess. Because I knew people there. And so I thought, well, I'm just going to go there and try it. And
it was nearly Mexico.
Yeah, it could have been Mexico. It could have been Spain, but it was Glasgow. But I loved the city. I found it like super full of energy, and I just loved it.
Do you feel in touch with the French scene at all, or is it just as far away from you as it is from us based in the UK?
Well, because I've been going to France less and less often, I must admit that I've kind of lost touch a little bit with France and with what's happening there in terms of comics.
We've been invited to Angoulême, though. We've been involved with French comics. We went to Angoulême for a good dozen years in a row from 1997 onwards.
Under your own steam or with the publisher?
Under our own steam. We did everything under our own steam. We just had a kind of mad impulse.
Mad obsession.
We worked all the time. We made our comics. We went to see people to talk about comics. It was just our life. We just made it our life. It's very enjoyable.
For anybody who's not been to Angoulême, and this includes me, can you describe it, especially for people who've only been to a British comic convention, which might be in a sports hall?
Well, it's basically a British comic convention times 10,000. It's pretty amazing. It's full of people. It's hugely inspiring. There's lots of exhibitions and talks, and it's, I guess, less centered towards the stand, kind of sell your own comics kind of thing. There are publishers exhibiting in stands, but it's all about the activities that are around these things. So exhibitions, yeah, a lot of talks. And also there's lots of school kids that go to it in the tens of thousands, I think.
There's a quarter of a million plus 250,000. And although it's changed over the years, it's still very vibrant and exciting and vital. I think it's also centred around the Museum of Bande Dessinée, the comic museum in Angoulême, which is fantastic. It's got original pages by Hergé, for example. It's also quite exhausting. Over a very short period of time, you meet thousands of people, all quite similar to you, because you can't meet many people with much more in common with you.
It sounds much closer to Glastonbury or the Edinburgh Festival than to any British comic festival that I think any of us have seen.
Yeah, yeah.
It's more akin to the Edinburgh Festival, I think, yeah. It's more like a cultural event. I think recognising the fact that in France, comics are seen as the ninth art.
Comics as the ninth art is always fascinating. I mean, seeing how seriously the French take it. Has anybody ever successfully named all other eight?
Big challenge.
Are you going to start dancing like architects, aren't
we? I think it's like naming the seven dwarves. You think, oh, obvious. But what have we got? We've got painting, we've got sculpture, we've got literature, I suppose. Ballet, poetry, I'm only up to five.
Film?
Cinema, yes.
Cinema, six.
Did you say dance?
Oh, I've already uncovered dance, yeah.
I think maybe architecture.
You said
of
that.
Course. Oh, no, you didn't say architecture. You said dancing about architecture, which is a quote from, is that Le Corbusier? I can't remember.
I think so, yeah. And then Elvis Costello.
Oh, I love it when we manage to get Elvis Costello and Le Corbusier in one sentence. Is your work published in France, in French?
Some of it is. The book that we contributed to for Dark Horse, it's published in French and Spanish. We did try and translate our stuff, but it's quite difficult.
Given that one of you is already equipped to translate into French, I think you've got a head start, haven't you?
You know, I'm losing my French, actually. I was just saying to John yesterday that I have major issues with spelling in French now, and I spell much better in English than in French, whereas obviously, when I moved, I was very good at it, but now I've lost it.
Also, I think people just assume that if you're good at translating or if you're a native speaker, then it's not an issue. But you lose associations, you lose connotations, you lose something, definitely. You may gain other things, but there are some words which just don't translate with the same associations. It's actually a very difficult thing to do.
Talking of changing the subject, your award winners. The winner of the Scottish Culture Awards for Best Visual Artist. That's a bit of an accolade, isn't it?
That was a moment to be completely gobsmacked. I usually talk for Scotland, but I completely was utterly gobsmacked.
It was unexpected.
Put it mildly. It was lovely. It's a really good recognition. But I think we've seen in a visual culture comics growing in stature. Maybe Ninth Arts still somewhere along the road, but it's certainly recognised. A lot of people pick up graphic novels the way they watch films, with a serious intention.
Well, also kids. Sometimes a lot of comic creators overlook kids because they want to do grown-up material, and they sometimes think that means making material that only grown-ups are allowed to read. But you've never let kids be left behind by your work, have you?
No, it's always been aimed for humans. I think it's all ages, yeah.
And you're adapting classic stories, and you've got The Little Mermaid, Bluebeard, and
Red Shoes.
What made you lead towards those stories?
That was an interesting thing, actually, because we were working on commissions, and at the time where that we started developing a couple of short stories, and we did that just to enter a couple of competitions. And one of them was an adaptation of The Little Match Girl. And then we didn't win the competitions, but we made the mini comic out of the short stories and sent it around to people that we'd met in the industry. And one of them happened to be Terry Nantier at NBM. And to our huge surprise, he actually got back to us within a few days and said he'd loved it and asked us if we'd be interested in creating a collection for them. So that was the start of our adaptations.
We'd made our own Louis books for more than a decade. We made five different stories. And Sandra redid the first Louis book, so there were six books, five different stories. And they're informed by classic literature, by nonsense verse, by ideas, you know, that are broad human ideas. But I think you'd reached a saturation point. You'd made enough Louis books by that point. It's a lot of work. And at that point that we reached, we thought, well, we need to get a publisher. We're just doing too much as well as the creative work. And also it meant it allowed us to rethink our creative process and change direction a little bit.
I've asked everyone on the panel to bring a panel to the panel. You'll be able to see the images that we're about to look at on my website at kevfcomicartist.com, and they should be on the artwork for the podcast episode, depending where you get your podcasts from. But don't worry if you can't see the images, because we're going to describe them. And we're going to begin by having a look at Sandra's panel. Now, usually I get the other guest who's never seen this picture to describe it, and they have no idea what they're looking at. John, I'm assuming you have seen Sandra's choice before.
Yes, I have, yes.
It's left then to me to have a guess at what we've seen. This is totally unfamiliar to me. So, listener at home, you shouldn't need to see this. Let's see how well I can sum this up. We are looking at a large square picture. It could be the whole of a square page, but it could, I think, be two-thirds of a page. We are seeing a train receding into a distance, going over a bridge, which is going over a viaduct, bridging a valley. There is a woman looking out of the window of this train. We're in sepia colours, as is she. She is young looking. She has large eyes, scared eyes. It's a semi-realistic style. Not totally realistic, though. She has cartoon big round eyes. The train receding into the distance is old, and it's pulled by a steam engine, making clouds of steam into the smoke, which suggests to us that we are in the past, as does the colouring, as does the text, which says, "We all knew what a call-up from the Nazi SS meant, but I also knew Father would never let it happen." So, we are in the 1930s or the Second World War, and this person going off on the train has got slightly ghostly figures surrounding her in the carriage. We can't see many of the faces, but the ones we can see are just black holes in ghostly white-shaped faces. So I fear that we could be looking at a story connected to the Holocaust. I'm even looking at the face of that person thinking that it could be, and this is where my guess is coming from, it could be Anne Frank. Are we looking at the Diary of Anne Frank?
You are. You totally are.
Genuinely a guess. I haven't Googled it. Sandra, tell me what this is from.
Well, I could have chosen a different panel from this graphic novel, which would have been less obvious. Obviously, the text here mentioning the Nazi SS was kind of a giveaway. So this is the Anne Frank's Diary graphic novel adaptation. And I think it came out just a few years ago, and it was adapted by Ari Folman and David Polonsky, who are also responsible for the animated film The Walls of Bashir. I'd read The Diary of Anne Frank, the book, actually quite late on in life. I read it when I turned 40. But this adaptation is just, it's totally amazing. And this panel in particular, when I saw it, I just thought, I'm just going to have to reread this book. It's just so well done.
Everything in the panel, you described it incredibly well, Kev. I think that's the eye and descriptive qualities of a cartoonist right there.
And you were right. It's two-thirds of a page.
It's two-thirds of a page.
And those colours, I didn't describe the red sky, but it's like the train is driving off into not a romantic sunset, but a furnace. There's even a shape in the rock on the far hillside, which is like a factory chimney.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Suggesting something that lies ahead. And the little heart of red surrounded by black cloud. It's just foreboding.
Well, this shape of the chimney that you just described, I totally didn't notice that, but that's another detail about this picture that is amazing. I like that it described, like, just visually, if you took off the text, this picture tells a story in itself. So you get the train driving in the distance and the sky is red, and that suggests basically death, as you said, the furnace. And I like that the black smoke is coming off the train, and that suggests, like, the chimney coming out of the concentration camp chimneys. I like that the train is, like, driving over an abyss, and also, like, the phantom-like faces inside the train, and, like, the people are reduced to being, they've been dehumanized, basically, and the only face that is recognizable is Anne Frank's face.
How does this color scheme match up with the rest of the book? It's not all done sepia and these colors, is it?
No, it's not. There's quite a lot of bright pastel colors, if that makes, it sounds like it's an oxymoron, but... yes, there's some nice greens and nice oranges. It's very, very well colored, actually. That's what I loved about the book the most, I think, is the coloring. And it's not actually done by the person who illustrated it. This an interesting thing about this book is that it's done by a team. So apparently the color is done by a different person, but also the storyboards are done by someone else again. So
it's the same team in part that did Waltz with Bashir, yeah. The film. So they're... usage of the term storyboards is probably more appropriate to film as an art form. You and I, or Sandra and I, would call it breakdowns, thumbnails, layout pages.
The end product is just perfect. It's very cohesive, and it's as if it had been done by just one person.
I think it's faithful to Anne Frank's diary tone as well, which I reread after Sandra read it, and I'd read it as a child. We also went to Amsterdam and visited Anne Frank's house. I think it's a very profound story. It's also quite humorous, quite light, given the depth of subject and the darkness that's there in the background. It's still quite a light story.
Yeah, the graphic novel adaptation really brings out the humour in Anne Frank's diary, which I'm assuming there's some kind of lightheartedness to the original material, but the comic version is very comic.
Of course, Anne Frank writing her diary doesn't know what's going to happen. She realise this, things are getting worse and worse, but she's still a 15-year-old child for most of it, I think I'm right.
I think she's a bit younger at the start. It
spans a few years, but she's quite forceful. She's got a unique voice, and it's quite a humorous tone, quite literary tone, otherwise it wouldn't be a classic. Mm-hmm. That's been retained, so the initial story's humour, the original story's humour, permeates the graphic novel. And it's not inappropriate. In every sense, it's a counterbalance to the tragedy.
Well, thank you for the diary of Anne Frank. I think it's time to see just how cheerful John's suggestion is. Listener at home, you'll find this on the podcast artwork wherever you get your podcasts from, or go to the website. I can't ask Sandra to describe it because she's seen it before, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
Which means it's down to me to describe. We are looking at a black and white line drawing intended to be printed in black and white, I would say. A figure is walking along Lower Manhattan. I think I'm right that it's Manhattan, aren't I? There is a figure walking across this actual map. So the figure is drawn on top of an actual reproduction of a map. And the figure looks, I would say, manga style in the line work, in the tones that are put on this guy's jacket. It's a man, a student age or in his 20s. He's got black hair swept across neatly in hairstyle that you'd see from the 20th century, but before usually the 1960s, carrying a textbook. So that's what makes you think that this person is a student. There's no dialogue at all. No thought bubbles, no captions, no nothing apart from the person walking across the map. The guy's just arrived in New York. He's acquainting himself with New York. I have no idea what book this is from, and I can't even guess. No, but I know Barefoot Jen is a book set around the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but I don't think this is that. So tell us, please, John, what is it?
It was not actually a manga. It's an adaptation of one of Paul Auster's short stories.
Oh, man! New York Stories by Paul Auster. I've read those.
This is an adaptation of the first of the three short stories in the New York trilogy, and it's called City of Glass. And the adaptation was done by Paul Karasek and David Mazzucchelli.
David Mazzucchelli! I actually interviewed David Mazzucchelli on stage at the comic convention. Maybe it was one of the ones in Glasgow, maybe the ones in London. And I had him on at the same time as John Romita Jr. And I suggested to David Mazzucchelli that did he possibly work from photo reference because his drawings were so realistic. And John Romita Jr. immediately picked up on the fact that I hadn't accused him of that. David Mazzucchelli, adaptation of Paul Auster's New York Stories. Oh, tell me more.
Well, this is City of Glass, and the reason I chose it is because I think it's a rarity. It's one of these works of art that adds to the original. I think you could argue the same of Sondra's choice, because the graphic novel certainly adds something to Anne Frank's diary, although Anne Frank's diary is incredible in and of its own right. But this is one where the themes of language and identity are interrogated, and it works very, very well. So the drawing style changes occasionally throughout the book. There's different little effects and different little ideas that are encapsulated in the drawing style itself. So it's using the comic medium to add to the themes and ideas that are inherent in the City of Glass story. New York Trilogy's three slightly related short stories, and this is the first one. It was published by Neon Lit, which are Art Spiegelman's imprint. So you can sense Spiegelman's intelligence and guiding hand behind this. It's an incredible piece of work. Very, very quick read, and it's been reissued recently. There's loads of ideas, like a fingerprint, zooming in on a fingerprint, zooming out, and it becomes a maze. Ideas about language. The characters in the book are having a tough time. All of them seem to be having some kind of breakdown or other. One of the characters has kept their son locked away in the hope that they'll utter the language of God, whatever that means. So it's interrogating ideas of language and identity. And so it looks at representation. So right away, you've got that encapsulated in this page. This is page 101. And the man walking on the map, he's not visiting, but in a way he is, because he's kind of lost.
Am I right in remembering that he traces some sort of image through the route he makes?
Traces letters. He's basically lost. He's looking for false meaning. Paul Auster's in the book, as you know. He's in his short story. He's also in this, and it is Paul and his wife, Siri Hustvedt, and their child. And there's a bit in it where our main character visits the Auster family, and it's as if the Auster, by offering him a beer and by being happy and contented and having a child, is mocking him because he's, you know, he's lost all these things. And he gets cartoon harpooned, which is another very effective image, which we almost chose.
Yeah, that's another book that you could have chosen an infinite amount of panels from, because it's a complete treasure trove in terms of what David Mazzucchelli does with the graphic novel form. It's just amazing. I would recommend anyone read it just for what you can actually do with the comic format.
Playing with the 9-panel grids, making it almost like a prison. Playing with the speech bubbles, second-guessing the reading. It's just so much in it. You can read it. I guess you'd read it an infinite number of times. It's an incredible little book.
Well, yes. Looking at this map, you're looking at the grid of New York, and New York's street grids, immediately for someone like ourselves, are suggesting the grids of comic strip pages.
Yeah,
that's right. So there's all these meta levels. And I know that makes it sound terribly dry, but above all, it's very entertaining. Very entertaining and rewarding.
Adaptations are something that you and I have both dabbled in. I've been doing the Shakespeare plays, and you, of course, have taken, ancient stories, sort of stories that were passed on by mouth or by Hans Christian Andersen. It's an interesting thing, the adaptation, isn't it?
We were really attracted to these stories. As children, we read them and got horripilation. We got, our hair standing on end and our skin standing on end, reading them. Very, very exciting. They tell us about ourselves, tell us about others. And I think as stories, they're quite basic, they're stories that we can relate to, transformations, the terror of a potentially murderous husband. I think Sondra brought an awful lot to the visual storytelling in Bluebeard. The ideas there, they can be crossed over to film, for example, the visual storytelling ideas. But they work best in comics. with the double page and the impact of the
reading. Well, see, this is very interesting, looking at New York Stories and looking also at Anne Frank earlier. They're shorter books. And the problem with adapting to comics is comics take up more space.
That's exactly what the authors of the Anne Frank Diary adaptation say in their notes at the end of the book. They said that if they had kept the integrity of Anne Frank's text, it would have ended up being a 3,500 page graphic novel. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's not a goer. So what they did is to summarize a lot of the chapters that she
I must wrote. Admit, I'm hard pressed to think of many novels or short stories adapted to comic books. Because when I was growing up, the equivalent or the only attempts being done were Classics Illustrated. Marvel did a whole line of the Classics Illustrated, taking things. I've got Homer's Odyssey and the Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde adapted into comics, but they were so truncated as to be almost a skim through the book, squeezed down into about 30 or 40 pages. It doesn't really adapt so much as a survey.
Well, when Edinburgh was the UNESCO City of Literature, Alan Grant and Cam Kennedy adapted Dr. Jekyll, Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. That's a great novella. That's one of the best pieces of Scottish literature. Robert Louis Stevenson's work is
again a novella. Yeah. So we've got a short enough inspiration to work with and then make it your own thing. Yes, Alan Grant and Cam Kennedy's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and also They're Kidnapped. Splendid books. But those are for another podcast. Here, we're still looking at Paul Auster's adaptation, drawn by David Mazzucchelli, written by whom?
Paul Karasik. Paul Karasik was an editor with Art Spiegelman and Francois Mouly on Raw. We're big fans of Raw, and I think also of the people who came out of Raw in many ways, like Richard Maguire and Chris Ware, and I guess in a way Daniel Klaus, and obviously Joe Sacco. A lot of these cartoonists are creating really interesting work in the field. And I think the intelligence brought to it is very telling, because it reads seamlessly. It's not losing anything in the adaptation, it's actually gaining, which we found really unusual. It's actually weird that we both chose adaptations.
Yeah, that was not
intentional.
Not intentional.
Well, thank you to Sandra Mars and John Chalmers, a.k.a. Metafrog. We've been looking at The Diary of Anne Frank, as adapted by Ari Folman and David Polonsky. And we have been looking at City of Glass. That's Paul Auster's City of Glass, as adapted by Paul Karasky and David Mazzucchelli. If you have any questions for us, you can find us at our social media. Guys, where do we find you on the socials?
You can find us on Twitter at Metafrog and on Facebook.
Metaphor Graphic Novels.
That's right. And also on Instagram.
We're on all the platforms.
And I'm on Twitter at Kev F. Comic Artist and at kevfcomicartist.com. Please click subscribe to be sure of hearing every episode when it comes out, and leave us a review, why don't you? Thanks again to Sandra and John, and to you for listening. I've been Kev F. And this has been Comic Cuts, the panel show.